very much, Ian. Open it up to comments, questions. Got Mitch, do you want to go first? And then
sure.
Doug,
I have actually one for Marissa, one for Ian. And actually, because you mentioned, Marissa, that it was, you know, surprising about how supportive he was of the Evertis and about fights about over Robespierre. But actually, Blanqui was completely in the tradition, his notes against Robespierre, because Babeuf wrote horribly scurrilous stuff about Robespierre after the Ninth Thermidor. So then Maréchal turned on Robespierre after the Ninth Thermidor. So there was a whole left of the revolution did kind of you know, turn on Robespierre, but you know, the people should still be so angry about it at so late a period. There's a story in one of the great books about the Paris Commune, Les Carnets Rouges, by Maxime Villon, who edited Père Duchesne of the French Revolution, where he visited an office of another newspaper, and he heard this terrible fight going on in the office. And they come out, the clothes are torn, and the glasses are broken, because one of them had said something bad about Robespierre to the other. So people took their Robespierre very seriously, you know, into the 18th century. So it really wasn't, you know, that surprising that he would have, like, an ambiguous point of view. And then on atheism, Ian, then you could answer this one. I think that in this case, you might have it wrong. This is a continuation also about discussion last year about laïcité. Atheism was at the heart of Dommager. And because he wrote that huge book on Jean Debier, Atheist, Communist, and Internationalist. His book on Sylvain Maréchal, which I'm translating, all that comes out that's at all good in the book is about atheism. So I think he was much more concerned with atheism, you know, I could be wrong, but atheism was really essential to Dommager, and he really stresses it everywhere that he can. And so it's not just a matter of education and secular education and taking the church out of the educational system. So, those were my...
Okay, thank you. Robespierre is still very contentious, I'm sure you know. So yeah, right through, you know, the 19th century, right up till the present day, people still get very, very hot under the collar one way or another about Robespierre. In a sense, he becomes a way of people to define where they stand on certain aspects of revolutionary politics. So, yeah, I mean, it was just, was it three, 4 years ago now that they found those papers, some papers that Robespierre had written, which were concealed by surviving members of the family with whom he lived, the Duplay family, that had been in hiding for all those years. And there was a huge ha-ha when these papers went on sale. And some people said, we should buy them because, you know, we need them for the country, and the government didn't want to, so we want nothing to do with them. And in the end, the government was shamed into buying them for the National Archives. But it was a hugely contentious thing. I mean, really, I mean, that's why he's interesting, frankly, I think so. And there's in what Blanqui says about Robespierre, you said he's ambiguous about him. He's not ambiguous. He hates him. It's really, really strong. And that I did find quite surprising, because it seemed quite Thermidorian in terms of what he said about Robespierre. And he gave him no credit for anything, you know, including the things like the Montos decrees. And there was nothing. It was quite sort of... seeing Robespierre as the person who'd subverted the revolution. And funnily enough, in attacking Robespierre, he even defends Danton, who's a much more ambiguous and corrupt figure. You know, that quote I gave, you know, one of the three things that Robespierre did against the revolution was raising a scaffold for Hébert and for Danton. And I found that quite surprising from a person like Blanqui. Babeuf, yes, by the time that they cut Robespierre's head off, Babeuf had nothing good to say about Robespierre, but he did change his mind later and said, yeah, I now think Robespierre and Sanchez were good eggs. better than the lot we've got now. I'm paraphrasing, but that is what he says later. Yeah.
I mean, just on Babeuf very briefly, there is one article which is very interesting, in which, if I recall it right, Babeuf talks about the two Robespierres, the good Robespierre and the bad Robespierre. He actually, if I dare use the word dialectical, you know, recognises the contradictions, the positive and the negative aspects of Robespierre. Obviously, another point of the thing was that when the Babeuvists start organising, they actually are trying to make a united front with some of the former Jacobins, and so obviously they had to try and take this position. I think it's also true that Buonarroti was much more sympathetic to Robespierre than Babeuf ever was. On the atheism, yes, it's true, I think, that that Dommelgé was very committed to atheism. Whether you can separate this from his commitment to laïcité, which was also very strong in his professional work in the teachers' union, I don't know. I have a problem with this, with the historical origins of laïcité, which I see as being very closely tied to French imperialism, particularly in the person of Jules Ferry. Also, I think, in a sense, there's something slightly un-Marxist about it. Because Marx argues that religion is the product of a class-divided society, that it is, what are the words, the heart of a heartless world. And therefore, insisting on atheism, before we've got rid of the social circumstances that give rise to atheism, is actually problematic. And I think I'll just finish on this. I think the early French Communist Party actually recognised this. I've just been looking at the history of a one of the founders of Algerian nationalism, a man called Hadj Ali Abdelkader, who was on the 1925 was on the Central Committee of the French Communist Party and was a practicing Muslim. And it seems to me that that has a relevance, and that there are dangers in this as it were excessive zeal for atheism. I speak as someone who's been an atheist for the last 50 years, at least, probably more.
Douglas.
I wanted to thank the speakers, and I have a number of points, but since Ian and I actually, now both our books will be published, or in your case, republished by the same publisher, my title, Spectres of Communism, was not a rebuff, it was a part of the homage. So, to Spectres of Babeuf, since I've written on Babeuf before. But on the subject of Babeuf and Blanqui, I thought there was vast differences in the methods of organization for Babeuf. Whereas Babeuf's conspiracy at its height in 1796, yes, there is like a central committee that of a select few who are military planning, but there is extensive outward propaganda of newspapers, leaflets, singing, you know, they're trying to subvert and break the army. The type of stuff that you really wouldn't see with a Blancas conspiracy. Like a much, I would say almost like a precursor to like later communist and socialist type politics. And in terms of French communists and Blancism or Blanqui, when the French Socialist Party split in 1920, Léon Blum actually said to the communists, you are reviving the spirit of Blanquism at that Congress. And the famous French communist André Matte, who leaded the Black Sea Mutiny, the International Brigades, and supposedly wanted to take power in 1944, gave the inaugural speech of the Friends of Blanqui in like 1950-51, right before he's expelled. Just a an interesting note.
I would have said your point really interesting about the difference between Babeuf's method of conspiracy and Blanqui's. This is one way in which I would assume that Blanqui learned from Babeuf, because Babeuf's conspiracy, of course, was infiltrated so very easily by the very people that because they were trying to bring. There's a military, I can't remember his name now, because of the G. And so this is the problem, but there's no way of easy way of getting over that, because Blanqui does the opposite, would do it really secretly, nobody will know anything else. But of course then when they, you're saying, they go out in the streets and nobody knows what's happening because nobody's been told. So how can you have any kind of successful revolt then? I don't quite know the way around that one.
If we did, we'd be out making the revolution instead of sitting here discussing Blanqui, wouldn't we? I agree with what you say, but that I think the Babeuf conspiracy did have much more of an orientation, what Damanger calls an orientation to the masses, and I think the recent book by Jean-Marc Chiappa, who has worked his way through thousands of police files, actually shows the extent to which Babeuf was able to actually build a national organisation. How much Blanqui knew about that? But certainly, I think he would have had contacts with Buonarroti. But there were, I think, also arguably significant differences between Buonarroti and Babeuf. So I think there's something else you said I was going to reply to, but I can't remember what it was now. So.
Pete?
Is there anybody else waiting? No, I've spoken quite a bit already.
Just a comment, really, about this quasi-multiverse anticipation of Blanqui. It just seems really stupid to say, well, that means he must have accepted that revolution was impossible. You could equally argue the opposite, that the idea implies that revolution's already thrived an infinite number of times. Of course, you might say that might provoke complacency, but it doesn't necessarily have the implication that was drawn.
I think that's right. I mean, he doesn't say so explicitly, but it would have been very ill-advised to do so. But of course, one of if you follow the logic of the argument, all right, there's this infinite number of worlds in which the Paris Commune has been crushed and Blanqui is rotting in jail. But maybe there's another infinite number of worlds in which Blanqui stayed out of jail, led the march on Versailles, and the Commune, I don't think the Commune could have been successful, but if the march on Versailles had succeeded and driven Thiers into making a further retreat, it could well be that the massacre would not have happened. Blanqui must have been very miserable when he wrote that that book. The Commune has been crushed. He's in jail indefinitely.
I don't see it like that. Here he is. He's in jail, he's got time to think. I didn't know about this till he mentioned it, but it reminded me of something like Bogdanov, for example, who was at one time one of the leaders of the Bolshevik faction within the Russian Social Democrats, but wrote science fiction stories. That sort of thing. Even Sputnik 1, the fact that rockets
going to launch things into space. Somebody had to work that out. That person was Tsiolkovsky, the Russian mathematics teacher, provincial math teacher, who actually wrote a book, A Method of Attaining Extreme Altitudes. It was euphemistically called, but you read it, you discover extreme altitudes are really, really extreme. But I mean, in 1921, with you know, the Civil War having virtually destroyed the whole of the Russian economy, the Bolshevik government actually takes him out of retirement in a provincial city, brings him to Moscow, and sets up an institute with him to actually develop his Russian space program. I mean, I think this is, you know, revolutionaries, not just revolutionaries in politics. And, you know, I think if you talk to people, they've also got imaginations about other things, and it's possibly just that. It's nothing about despair or anything like that. It's just Blonsky's imagination revealing itself to be wider than merely sort of the next few years.
And actually, I think Dominique, in her brief note, describes it as a prose poem. But somewhere there, maybe it was described as a prose poem. Because it's hard, frankly, to take it very seriously. But it's a beautifully written piece.
Well, it's... did you translate it?
It's actually in the process of... I've translated bits of it that are on Marxist.org, but poor Philippe is working on it now.
Right, because there is a version of it on the Marxist.org.
Yeah, I did that.
That's yours, right?
There's a full version.
Yeah, there's a full version of it that came out a little while ago.
There's two translations already.
You never have too many translations of this text. I mean, one thing to add on that is it has a mournful tone in parts. He does say it's going to happen again and again, and it's all going to be monotonous. But I totally agree with you. Benjamin is really wrong. You can't infer anything from the cosmological argument about his politics or anything remotely like a surrender or resignation. In fact, on the contrary, in order to say that Benjamin has to really willfully misread the text, what Blonsky insists on is that there's no relation. Whatever happens at the level of the stars and so on is totally irrelevant to the decisions we make in this world, which is all that matters to us. And it's very emphatic, in fact, in the work. So I think that's really an important point to make. I had a couple of other things, little responses. One to Marisa about the relation to Robespierre. It's a pedantic point, perhaps, but he's not quite so unequivocal as those notes that Mathias published about Robespierre, because in 1834, for example, and really I think Dominique mentioned this before, really up until 1848, when he does mention, we're missing a lot of the material, but when he mentions Robespierre, it's in fact positive. And the main places in 1834 in the text, equality is our flag or our banner. And there, Robespierre is a hero, along with Jesus Christ, actually, along with a bunch of other, and pretty firmly as heroes of equality, and maybe Babeuf is in there too, and if not, he certainly could have been. And it's, as Dominique was talking about this morning, it's really in 1848 when unscrupulous people, in Blanqui's eyes, use the mask of the mountain and of Robespierre to cover their actual, you know, more or less counter-revolutionary political project, that's when Blanqui's position changes and becomes much more forcefully critical. And that's, in fact, a very Robespierre-ist type of response, right? And it's exactly, you asked the question... How do you trust them? How do you know if they're virtuous? How do you know if they're dedicated? What's the tell, you know, that they're authentic? And Blanqui is, in fact, quite preoccupied with that question, I think, particularly in 1848, but also after 1830. How do you trust them? And he has a pretty Robespierre-ist answer, which is, well, look at what they do. And in particular, look what they do around the question of popular empowerment and popular armament. So if these people, the first thing they say is, disarm the people and bring in the professional army, then you know that they're traitors. And as soon as they call for that, you have to, and Robespierre says that repeatedly as well, if people are calling for the troops from the frontiers and so on to come around, well, then we know that we're in trouble. So that Girondin demand that you have 20,000 people come and protect the convention is a complete tell, right? So I think actually Robespierre and Blanqui are, in fact, share a lot of things despite Blanqui's vigorous polemic. It's true that you can't get over the religion thing. But Robespierre's challenge that atheism is aristocratic would have been a real, I think, a point that Blanqui should have thought about a little bit more. That was a comment. And the question that I have for you, Ian, is Maybe one of the questions that's emerged over the course of the day is a central point, which is this relation to the masses, the lack of a sufficiently fleshed out relation to the masses, whether that takes the form of the party as a mediator, as Doug was suggesting, or whether it needs a more robust account of education. And I can see why Demanger makes that argument, or why you would make that argument, or others would make that argument. But again, I feel that you could flip it around and say that the fact that Blanqui is kind of curiously insouciant on this question doesn't have a project of, say, political indoctrination or a mechanism or an institution or anything like an organization that would accomplish that, could be said to be a kind of virtue as well of his position. That if you're going to, because as you say, the classic problem here is the educator, educating of the educator. So if, as Marx is referring to, you know, Owen and top-down reformists, some of this utopian socialists maybe, and it's Rousseau's problem of formulated as the legislator in the social contract, the person, in other words, who comes in with all the answers and basically tells people how to think, or broadly puts out a blueprint, this is how we should proceed. And Blanqui refuses to do that, right? Again and again, Dominique talked about this too, and it's come up repeatedly. He says people should educate themselves, or there should be education, by which he really means basic instruction, you know, science, math, all that stuff. But after that, it's like he basically just trusts people to think things through. He's really enormously confident in people's capacity to think for themselves. And you have to wait really a long time, I think, before you again get that kind of... You get it a bit in... people who refuse basically to lay down a script you get it a bit in South, I think, also. I'm not going to tell you how to figure this out. Figure it out, is basically how he says. And you have the resources that you need to find that. And we could argue that perhaps then he doesn't address this question of how to relate to the masses enough. Why doesn't he have more of a mass organization? Why isn't he entrenched? Why doesn't he have his people selling newspapers on the corners more emphatically? Or he does do that to some extent. But it's largely, I think, because he's very confident that you don't need to do that. People educate themselves. The process is underway where it can occur, which is to say in the cities that are relatively free thinking. And our real task is to lift the hand of oppression in the countryside and elsewhere. And after that, it's not our problem.
And if I could just add, Ian, before you answer that, actually it's in Un Dernier Mot, in his passage against the Germans, it's not a racial one, he talks about, yes, the Germans might be better educated, but what do they do with their brains once they're educated? Mm. And if they use their brains just to accept authority, then they're no freer than anybody else. Yeah. So it's like, it's not just a matter of being educated, it's what you do with the education.
Yeah, thinking for yourself.
Thinking for yourself, exactly. That's, right. That's what he accuses the Germans of not only not doing, but not being capable of doing.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I take that, but I think there's also a recognition in Blanqui of the power of ideology, of how much the population is under the grip of ideology, and he's particularly concerned with those institutions which propagate ideology. And this, I think, is part of his reason for being so hostile to the church, which, of course, right up to the year of Blanqui's death, still effectively controlled education. It's only with the Ferry laws, which are just about the time of Blanqui's death, that the education system's taken out of the hands of the church and put into the hands of the state. So I think there's a problem, perhaps there's a contradiction there, you know, that he has this great confidence in what the people can do, but at the same time he sees this enormous weight of ideology that has to be lifted.
Just to answer as well, your point there, really interesting. I was aware that he was like more positive about Robespierre early on. 1848 is the thing that changes him in that experience, isn't it? But I think, yes, the thing is that men of the First French Revolution shouldn't be treated as either heroes or monsters, but kind of understood.
Yeah.
And your point really, that he could have better worked a little harder, relates to what you were saying, to understand Robespierre's ideas about religion, because that would have been helpful, not really about Robespierre, but about how people's
yes.
minds work and what people's needs are and what the Festival of the Supreme Being was supposed to do. And perhaps to try and understand how these are people in very particular circumstances trying to do certain things and the problems they came up against. So to dismiss them as either heroes or monsters really doesn't really help that much. It means to take up a position.
Marissa, on the question of like what's in people's hearts, you were talking
oh.
about that.
Perennial
well,
problem.
I know it's dear to
yeah,
your
go.
Heart. But there's actually two things that came to mind.
Yeah.
One was Mirabeau was one of the first people to be put in the Pantheon. And when they found out
then
he
take
was,
it out again.
He had his body was removed from the Pantheon. But also there was the role that the revolutionaries played in impugning each other. You know, constantly. So, for example, you know, Danton, you know, the you know, whether it was true or not that he was in, you know, he was betraying the revolution. So, it would have just increased the cynicism, you know, the general cynicism. If they have people that they admired yesterday, now their comrades are telling them that they will always work.
Yeah. No, absolutely. But that's what my book's about, really, is that whole kind of problem they're caught up in. That's what I'm saying, that they're caught up in those French revolutionaries. And, yeah, Mirabeau is the archetypal, you know, he was one of the good guys until everybody realised actually he was quite corrupt and taking huge backhanders from the court. And so he's out of the Pantheon. Who are they going to put in his place? And Marat, yes, it's painful. It really is painful in terms of how they're trying to sort of feel that thing through. But there is, you know, how can you prove it? The last chapter of my book really is quite grim. It's all about people going to their executions still trying to prove that they're virtuous. And the only way that they can do that is by not accepting that the Revolutionary Tribunal is white. So Madame Roland chooses to go in a white dress to her execution, and she's really steadfast. And you might think, well, it doesn't matter anymore because, you know, you're going to be dead soon. She knows perfectly well. But it still mattered. It still mattered that people judge them for what was in their hearts. You know, and you look at some of the memoirs that the Girondins on the Run wrote, the same thing. They're both attacking the Montagnards, saying how they hate them and how they all were acting in bad faith, and also defending themselves. And those things really matter to people. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, makes people make those sorts of commitments, I think, in politics, is that real need to show what their authentic self was. So it did matter.
Any last question? Philippe had to leave, so I'm just going to fill in for him at the end here. Yeah, what I propose is that we take a few moments if we want. I think it's been a pretty full day and we can wrap up soon. But if there were questions that people have been sitting on, either for our speakers now or for anybody else, anything else that came up over the course of the day, particularly maybe people who haven't spoken already or who just have a question that you've been sitting on, this would probably be a good time to ask it. Maybe while you're thinking, I want to just on Dominique's behalf, translate three comments that she made in discussion during the break, which refer back to our discussion in the previous panel, if you'll allow this, and they touch on three points. So one was the question of Blanqui's anti-Semitism, allegations of anti-Semitism, and she's looked at this question in some detail and concluded that there really isn't any real justification for that. There are some rhetorical motifs that are pretty stock stuff of the period, but that what emerges strongly is his rigorous and consistent anti-religious position, which is just all inclusive. So he you know, to the point of obsession, critical of Islam as well as Judaism, as well as Christianity, and in particular Christianity. I mean, the Catholics by far, I think, are the dominant target of his polemics. That's a first point. The second is the question of violence and political violence, and in relation, for example, to say proto. Sort of Bolshevik-style levels of violence. And I think we have to make a distinction here, Dominique was saying, between the need for political violence in the sense of overcoming the resistance put up by the established order. So if it's a revolution and the task is to win, you must indeed do what is required to win. But nothing more than that. There is nothing in Blanqui that's the equivalent of, for example, purging a regime or liquidating opponents in the way that would then become relatively routine in the 20th century. For example, he will say that we should indeed expel priests and aristocrats, but never talks about saying we should kill priests, for example. There's nothing like a a justification or a call to any kind of pogrom or something like that in Blanqui. And when there is occasional violence that's not justified, when a soldier is killed, for example, in a kind of regrettable incident, then Blanqui is himself appalled and regrets it very much. So I think, yes, he's very hard-nosed or realist about political violence, but in no sense an apologist for mass murder or lynchings or anything like that. So I think that's perhaps important to remember. And third and final point that Dominique was mentioning is that a little, perhaps unlike the Bolsheviks in this sense, although, of course, Blanqui has a line and he has people who broadly adhere to it or not, and if they're members of the conspiratorial organizations, then, of course, they're people who are very much in his inner circle. And just parenthetically, though, remember that Blanqui's not constantly on that position. He supports and is involved in conspiratorial work mainly in the late 1830s and the 1860s because there is no alternative. It's that or just go to sleep politically. You can't do... After 1834, remember, you know, he tries to have a public newspaper, he tries to organize in public, but the repression is too strong. If you're going to continue with politics, you have to go conspiratorial. So he does that again in the 1860s when Napoleon's repression is comparably strong. But as soon as that's lifted, he takes totally different approaches, right? In 1848, it's very public, in 1870s again. But in the periods when he is indeed on a more conspiratorial line, although he wants people that they can trust, you know, and he sort of networks his way around trying to figure out who are the reliable people in this crowd or in this club or in this moment, there's not, I think, the same sense of we need our party to have a monopoly on power. You don't really have that, I don't think, in Blanqui, maybe because they never had the opportunity, never successful enough. But my sense is it really is kind of foreign to his way of thinking. It's that we need people who we trust in the moment of confusion and crisis that follows victory. So the regime collapses, there's an opportunity, people have a chance to take power, and in that moment, all kinds of devious, untrustworthy people can exploit the situation, and indeed will exploit it. And so in that moment, you need people who are principled, who are clear, who anticipate that, and who can be trusted. But basically, to do a couple of initial fundamental measures, and Dominique, I think, mentioned one or two of them this morning, and mainly he talks about these in early March 1848, and then again in the text on communism, which ends with a series of immediate measures, I think is what his term. And there are a list of things that you have to do immediately. For example, you have to secure the military question. You can't allow for an immediate counter-response that would crush you. You can't allow for immediate capital flight. You know, that's again a point that anybody today would understand. You can't, you know, a certain number of things like that have to be secured. But that's all that he says. So do those, that's not already, it's not trivial. Do those things, and then after that, then you have a situation in which basically, again, people can figure out what has to be done. You don't have a program that says our party should monopolize power, it should, if necessary, you know, overrule a constituent assembly and stack it with our people. You really don't have that. My own view is that he would have remained very fundamentally Rousseauist or Robespierriste in this sense, or Marattiste, in that you mustn't trust a government, any government, including our government, including ourselves, that he would have applied that, and quite likely, I think, would have, it's total speculation, but would have encouraged the people who helped that transition to then perhaps remove themselves from the political process to make way for something more like a mass political process. I just wanted to add that on behalf of Dominique, who made these points during the discussion. J'espère que tu me fais confiance, que je viens de résumer ton argument.
Oui, tout à fait. Simplement, dans ces textes, par exemple, si je reprends un tout petit peu ce que tu as dit vaguement, ce que je comprends de ton discours, si on regarde les textes, par exemple, mon personnel jeu est très absent.
Yeah. So if you look at his text, he very rarely uses the personal first person pronoun I. That's right. Are there any other points or questions that, yes?
Yes, this to you actually, about the Blanqui archive.
Yes.
What are you trying to do that's different from what they're doing with the Marxist archive, or the Blanqui archive on that?
Well, something far more modest, for one thing, because it's just, what we're doing, if you look at it, you'll see the tabs are already there, but basically we're assembling what can be assembled relatively easily, which is to say we can get scans of all the manuscripts, so that's been, the Bibliothèque Nationale has done that. and we'll be able to assemble them at relatively good resolution. They've just posted on their own Gallica site poor quality scans of the manuscripts, much better than nothing. But when we move the site to Kingston's server, the really big files are 2 or 3 gigabytes per volume. We'll have the best quality scans that you can have of the manuscripts, and that's 26 volumes, 500 or 600 pages each, so it's quite a lot of stuff. We've gathered all the published texts in the newspapers, things like Candide that he published in 1865. So that's all together in one place. The articles that we can get hold of on him and about him, so Rancière has an interesting piece, Daniel Ben Saïd and Michael Levy have an interesting piece, Miguel Abansour has an interesting piece, and then there's some older texts that are out of copyright, so we've assembled them. All the texts that we've translated, the three of us, so Mitch, Philippe and I, are already there, and we'll be adding a few more, including yet another translation of this Eternity by the Stars thing. And there'll be a chronology that'll link these things together, make it easier to navigate what the course of his life and of the period. And finally, and this is the most open-ended thing, we're assembling some critical reflections or assessments from different people, including people like Rosa Luxemburg or Trotsky and Lenin and others, as well as 19th century people who refer briefly to Blanqui so that you can kind of flesh out the way he's been received or understood or described. So that's it. It doesn't really aspire to do anything else, but there's some photographs and things like that. So. And there'll be, by the way, recordings, if that machine has been working well, of this conference on there too.
I have a question, actually. I think if you're the one to answer it, but I started by saying, you know, when I looked at the very recent historiography,
yes.
He seems to have dropped out of sight. Is that kind of post-1989? Or
I think it's pre-1989. When you say, I thought your points about that were right on, but I think you go back, I mean, already, when Walter Benjamin talks about Blanqui, he's a little more on target when he says, this guy was the kind of most... You know, in a way, the most forceful name in the communist tradition, the revolutionary tradition, a clarion call and so on, his notes on history, the philosophy of history, concept of history, sorry, from 1939-40, but he's been totally forgotten, and already by then forgotten. So I think Demanger was already a bit of an exception. And I would say that apart from, I mean, even Mathias, who was best placed in a sense to understand why Blanqui mattered, because of this business with Robespierre, he basically blocks him too. So I think he was forgotten really from the early, relatively quickly after the Russian Revolution. Doug, do you have Doug,
about the forgetting of Blanqui? About 2 or 3 weeks ago, I happened to be discussing with a Russian immigrant who still identifies as a Marxist, and he got in contact with me because of my own writings on Blanqui, and I don't know how representative what he says is, but I have my suspicions that it is. He said, in the Soviet Union, Blanqui was just characterized as a utopian, dismissed quite readily, and he told me he didn't even know Blanqui was a communist.
Oh.
Which was... And if you were actually to read, like, you know, Progress Publishers, when they existed, put out all, like, those really bad textbooks on everything, like, Blanqui is, like, explicitly referred to as a utopian there.
But there was the anthology before Dominique,
yes.
Was done by
Volgin.
Yeah.
By Volgin. But what says it all is in English, all that I know about is Neil Stewart's biography, Bernstein's book, and the fact that nobody translated Blanqui at all into English until I did 12 years ago pretty much says it all.
And
it's been something available, you know, in English.
There's also Alan Spitzer's.
Yeah, Spitzer's book, which if you want to read a little more about Blanqui, then the best little book in English, I think, is currently waiting for Doug's book to come out, but is Alan Spitzer's book. Is it called The Ideas?
The Revolutionary Ideas,
Ideas
of
Auguste Blanqui, yeah, which is about 120 or 40 pages, and you can get it. It's a little hard to find. It's online, but it's on a pay service, Questia.com. You can find it there.
Sorry, who is it, Bobby?
By Spitzer, Alan Spitzer.
He also wrote a book on the Carbonari.
Any other last points to throw in? Yeah.
Can I just do one reply to the thing about Blanqui not calling for a one-party state or anything like that?
Yes.
Which I assume is a comparison with Lenin and state in Soviet Union. But of course, Lenin never called for a one-party state before the revolution. I mean, it's events that produced that. So, I mean, I don't think you can judge Blonky. Yeah, what would he have done? Well, it would have depended on what would happen had he actually managed to seize power. I think, you know, it's a...
This is not the place to have this discussion, but
no, it's not a new discussion.
Perhaps over in the pub, yes, but it's not maybe just events, because for someone like Zinoviev, it's not maybe an accident that it wound up being a one-party state, if you ask me. But
well,
but we can,
yeah,
why don't we discuss this?
Big subject.
Yeah.
Exactly. Zinoviev wasn't Lenin.
Yes.
No, exactly. It's true. And,
exactly.
Let's discuss that in the pub. But can we perhaps on that note finish? And I just wanted, before we thank our speakers, just a couple of tiny practical remarks. There's two trays of sandwiches in the back. If you're hungry, please eat them. Ideally, eat one of them, and I'll take the other one out and put it at the front desk where other people can eat it. That's the first thing. I think for a pub, if you saw on the program, we left this a bit open. I think maybe it's the Wagon and Horses is probably the best option. It's a little closer. And so if you'd like to come and join us for a drink there, that's on the way to Surbiton. You can just go as a group. And is there anything else I've forgotten? Don't think so. So really just remains to thank everybody very much for coming, and to thank all of our speakers, and particularly the last panel there. And thank you very much for a great day.